hypothetical case where I'm told that Richard's getting richer, some of those might be people who started out as my peers and their incomes have gone up and mine haven't. And even if it's not true, even if the number of people above me is the same, whether they have twice my income or 10 times my income is going to affect how I feel about my status relative to them. Anyway.
Isn't that going to affect price of goods too, though? If people have like more money, you're going to like...
But that's by richer, we're usually talking about real income, not nominal income. And so any change in prices we've already factored out in describing that. That is, if people are becoming more richer because what they're doing is more productive, then there's more stuff out there, and I can consume some of it. All right. What I'm going to be talking about today overlaps with what the first three sections of the chapter discuss, but it isn't identical. And I want to really start with my perspective on what economics is, since it's what I've spent a good deal of my life doing, and I think it's interesting. And end up discussing some of the same, I mean, in a certain sense, the important stuff in those first few sections is explaining supply curves, demand curves, and in particular consumer and producer surplus, because consumer and producer surplus are a way that most people who haven't studied economics know nothing about of getting at least a first cut on how much better off or worse off we are. And that's something one often gets wrong. And so let me start with what economics is. And from my standpoint, economics is a way of understanding behavior. In principle, it isn't even limited to human beings. You can use economics to try to understand animals' behavior. You can really, from an economist's standpoint, evolutionary biology is largely the economics of genes, how do genes achieve their objectives, as it were. We mostly apply it to humans. And it's not limited to what non-economists think of as the economy. That, from my standpoint, economics is relevant to understanding marriage, to understanding child rearing, to understanding schooling, to understanding pretty much everything human beings do. And what's special about economics? It starts with one very simple assumption, which we call rationality, which is somewhat confusing because it's not exactly what other people mean by rationality. But what we mean by rationality is that human beings have purposes, and that the best way of predicting their behavior is they will take the actions that achieve those purposes. That's the pattern of human behavior. It's not a statement of how people think. It's not saying the way you decide is to work out some elaborate logical structure, set up a spreadsheet. That one of the ways I sometimes put it is I'm pretty sure I know the fastest way home from my office, but I've never actually, you know, done geometric calculations, run it through a spreadsheet. It's by trial and error, and I'm pretty sure that at the time this class ends, taking surface streets is the fastest way home, and at the time when my first class, at the time when I come to work, taking the interstate is the fastest way here because of the changing traffic. So the statement is somehow or other people find a way of finding out what's the right action to take, however they do it. And my sort of standard examples when I'm talking about this are cats and babies. I don't know how many of you have had a cat as a roommate, but presumably some of you probably have. And you may have discovered what happens when in the morning you are reading the newspaper when you ought to be petting the cat. And cats, being rational animals, solve this problem by lying down on the newspaper. And since you can't read the newspaper through the cat, you take your second best alternative and pet the cat. And my guess is that cats do not know what newspapers are. They don't know what reading is. They can't figure this out logically. But at some point in the past year or two, the cat happened to lie down there because it was a convenient place and close to the person who was supposed to pet him. And sure enough, it worked. And cats, being clever creatures, then repeat the experiment. My baby example, I don't know, some of you may at some point in your life have been babies. It's a not uncommon experience. So think yourself back to about 2 months or so. And you are there in a world which is sometimes unpleasant and uncomfortable, and you have only one tool to control the world. Your hands won't yet go where you tell them to go. Your feet won't go where you tell them to go. But you can make noises. You can control what noises you make. So when you are wet or hungry, you make loud, unpleasant noises, and big people come and fix the problem. That is rational behavior. Given the very limited tools you've got, I can't think of a better way for the baby to achieve its objectives, so it's acting rationally. So that way of putting it, I think, helps to make it clear that rational doesn't mean we're all Dr. Spock, Mr. Spock, even putting aside the fact that Star Trek got badly wrong how a rational person would behave when they were creating Mr. Spock. but rather that in some average approximate sense, we tend to find the right answer. It's clear that it isn't a perfectly accurate description of human behavior. That I observe, for example, that when there's a bowl of potato chips next to me, after a while it's empty, even though I know I'm overweight and shouldn't be eating potato chips. But it describes a lot of human behavior, and maybe the part we can best predict. And I discussed a little bit, I think, last week, some possible alternative approaches, but I'm going to forget about that for this week and just take the straight economic view in which we say there's rational behavior and then there's random error. And there are some contexts where the assumption of rationality works better than it should. For example, the CEOs of firms are not chosen at random. They tend to be people who are really good at maximizing profits. That's how they got to be CEOs. So it's a better prediction for them than it would be for people in general. And there are sometimes large markets where random behavior cancels out because some people pay too much and some people pay too little. What does economics apply to? And I guess my real answer is we find that out by trying. That you try to apply it to any form of behavior at all. If you learn something useful and it fits the data, then it applies to it. My first published journal article was an economic theory of the size and shape of nations, in which I attempted to explain the broad features of the map of Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the present. And I started out with a very simple puzzle that didn't seem to have bothered anybody else, and that was, when the Roman Empire fell, why did it break? All right, if you look at the world, look at Europe in 400 AD, and you see this immense superstate, which they've probably lost England by then, but they've got all of Spain, all of France, all of Italy. If you count the Eastern and Western Empire as one, they've got all of the Middle East, all of Greece, all of North Africa, one country. You now look at the world in 900 AD, and what do you see? This little tiny patchwork of baronies and duchies and stuff, where, you know, the King of France had a smaller army than the Duke of Normandy, for example. So where, in effect, the real size of nation has shrunk down. Why did that happen? And that was what the article was really about, and it then went on to explain other things later on in history. So that's economics, even though it's not about prices and unemployment and stuff like that. It's about human behavior, in this case political behavior, that leads to certain outcomes. Economic analysis of law, I usually start out in explaining what it's about by saying, suppose we're in a legal system where the most severe punishment is life imprisonment. Somebody says armed robbery is a really bad crime. We should give life for armed robbery. And the legal philosopher says, is that just? Constitutional scholar says, is that cruel and unusual punishment? And the economist says, do you really want armed robbers to routinely murder their victims? Because after all, if the punishment for armed robbery and the punishment for murder is the same, the additional punishment for the murder is zero, and if you kill him, he can't identify you in a police lineup. So that's an application. I'm not going to go through. Well, I think we're going to do economic analysis of law later, so I will just mention that other things you can apply it to is, should contracts be enforced under duress? And when you think it through, it turns out to be a much more complicated and interesting question than it seems, and that there are some circumstances in which we're better off if contracts made under duress are enforceable. Peace treaties, for example. It's hard to think of more duress than dropping bombs on people. And yet the world is probably better off if, once you surrender, you don't... There is something that keeps you from starting the war again in another 6 months, and something that keeps the other side from doing things other than they agreed to on the surrender terms. And one of my favorite examples, the Pinochet case. Pinochet was a Chilean governor, Chilean general who had a military coup and was the dictator of Chile for a while, and various people he didn't like disappeared. Eventually, he made a deal. He said, I will restore democratic government, but only if you agree to hold me and my people immune for prosecution for anything that happened while we were running things. And the deal was accepted, and quite a long while later, various people tried to reverse that deal and to prosecute Pinochet for things he had supposedly done. Is it a good thing to have that deal reversed? Well, on the one hand, knowing that when you hand over power, you won't get prosecuted for murdering people makes you more willing to murder people while you're in power. But on the other hand, knowing that if you hand over power, you will get prosecuted for murdering people while you're in power is a good reason never to hand over power. And thus, you've really got a tension between incentives on the one scale and incentives to reduce or increase the damage done by duress versus incentives to do duress versus not do duress. So I can go through at greater length. But they're interesting cases. Politics, there's a sort of what I think of as the high school civics class theory of democracy, which is it works because we vote for the guys who do good things and against the guys who do bad things. For that to work, the voter has to know what people are doing and whether they're good things or bad things. A voter has no reason to know those things because a rational voter realizes that in a large polity like the U.S., the chance that his vote will affect who is president is essentially zero. So therefore, why should you spend many hours? And the usual experiment, I'll try it in this class, is to ask how many people here know the name of their congressperson. One does. All right, two people, three people. You must be enthusiasts. There's no good reason you should know it except for curiosity. But if you don't know it, you obviously can't follow I should say I don't know who my congressperson is. I've probably been told at some point. But since, for most of us at least, we aren't going to be able to influence what happens anyway, we end up being rationally ignorant of that and of many other things where the information isn't useful to us. A standard example of application of economics to warfare is you imagine that you are part of a line of 3,000 men 1,000 years ago with spears, and the spears are pointed that way. Why are you doing it? There is a similar number of people on horseback with spears coming towards you, and you do a very quick profit-loss calculation to decide what you should do. And you say to yourself, if we all stand and keep our spears pointed at them, with luck we'll stop their charge, and some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses can outrun us, so I should stand. Oops, sorry, I made a mistake. I don't control him and him. The question isn't what we should do, it's what should I do. If they stand and I run, one guy out of 3,000 isn't going to have much effect on our chance of stopping them, but if we do stop them, I won't be one of the guys who gets killed, and if we don't stop them, at least I'll have a head start. On the other hand, if they run and I stand, I'm dead. So I should rationally run. Everyone does the same calculation. We all run and most of us die. What I like to think of as the dark side of rationality, where individual rationality. Yeah?
No. Where you are in the phalanx, if you're near the back, you're like, those guys in the front are doing so well.
It was a line.
Time to go.
I understand. Yes. And one of the solutions to this is that the rear line of a more complicated formation is people whose orders are to kill anybody who runs. There are lots of ways that real armies try to control the problem. My point is only that straightforward economics points out that the sort of board game version of warfare has to be wrong, because those are not pieces on the board. Those are human beings. It's true the human being wants his side to win, just like the general does, and the human being wants to survive the battle, just as the general wants him to survive the battle. But the relative priority of those two things for the general and the soldier is not the same. All right? And making sense of historical warfare, I think, is easier to do if you think about it in those terms. My guess is that one of the talents of really good generals is putting units on the other side in a situation where it was in their interest to run, because when they run, you don't have to fight them. And that then exposes the next unit. Silent student problem, I think I've discussed with you before my solution to the silent student problem of having some way in which a student can tell me that he did or didn't understand something without having to identify himself so that I can find out when nobody's following it. Divorce rate, one of the ways in which the world has changed radically in even my lifetime, and certainly in my parents' lifetime, my mother's lifetime, my father's not alive anymore, is that marriage is much less likely to be a lifetime commitment. And then the question is why? And I think if you apply economic analysis to the general subject of long-term contracts, and you say one of the reasons we have long-term contracts is that the contracting parties get involved in relationship-specific investments, that you have two firms, one of them is specializing in producing an input for the other, it's therefore in real trouble if the other decides to stop buying it, so you sign long-term contracts to arrange for that. That a marriage is a situation where the two parties have sizable investments, most of them non-monetary, in things that are common to the relationship, such as their kids. There are costs, therefore, to breaking it up, and that gives you some reasons for long-term arrangements. However, one of the other big changes of the last 200 years is that nowadays babies don't die. All right, that's a slight exaggeration, but not much for developed countries. It used to be the case that in order to make sure you had two or three surviving children, you had to produce children almost nonstop during the wife's fertile years. Nowadays, two children will do it. What does that mean? It means that wives are less specialized to being wives than they used to be. They are, therefore, the costs of breaking up a marriage, at least to exist, are less than they used to be. That, I claim, is one reason why marriages have become less stable. So that would be one example of the general point. Anyway, as I say, we find out what economics applies to by trying to apply it. If we end up knowing more than we did before, then that's something economics applies to. There are a bunch of conventional applications, which is what the book is discussing and what most economics books discuss, involving explicit markets, prices, inflation, unemployment, and the like. The ideas of economics have mostly been worked out in that context, which is part of the reason why when I start thinking about divorce, I take a brief detour to think of companies making contracts with each other. So we've thought it through in that context, and we can then apply it to the different context. And that's what you do mostly, but it's fun to also detour from time to time and see how these same ideas apply to other things. All right. Let me start with the reason that the society we live in can't possibly exist, because that's a puzzle which economics helps to solve. That every one of us depends for his daily survival on millions of people. All right? Probably nobody in this room grows his own food. Probably, almost certainly none of us weave our own cloth, and probably most of us don't even sew our own clothes, though one or two of us might have occasionally done that. If you trace back the number of people involved in producing almost anything, it's an enormous number. There's a famous essay called I, Pencil, in which somebody looks at a pencil, and he says, how many people did it take to produce this pencil? Well, it's got wood. To produce the wood, you needed chainsaws. To produce the chainsaws, you needed steel and gasoline and a bunch of other metals and materials. To make the steel, you needed blast furnaces, which required, and you just trace it back. That's just the wood. We've got that little metal band that's got the eraser on it. Think about tracing that back to all the people it took to make that. Ditto for the so-called lead, which is really graphite. Ditto for the rubber at the other end of it. All right? And his point, which is right, is that modern societies involve coordinating the activities of a very, very large number of people, each of whom is contributing a little bit to what's happening. I have a different set of examples on the slide, but it's really the same basic point. And then the problem is, how do we work this miracle? How do I make sure that if I want to make a pencil, someone's cut down a tree? And if he wants to cut down a tree, someone's made a chainsaw. And not just a chainsaw, the right number. We don't want to have a situation where there are 100 loggers and only 12 chainsaws. Or 100 loggers and 1,000 chainsaws. That's a big waste of chainsaws. So somehow you've got to coordinate this whole system to get everybody to play his role in the dance. And there are really two answers, only one of which works on a large scale. The obvious answer is central direction. The obvious answer is that somebody says, we need to do, you do that, you do that, you do that, let me work. All right, we've got to have six of you do this, five of you do this, and so forth. And that's presumably the way football teams work. To some extent, it's how firms work or families work. And the problem is that it doesn't scale. That when you try to do that for more and more people, all that information is funneling through one head, which can't handle it. And the number of layers of sending orders down is getting larger, which means that the ability of people at the bottom to get information to the top or people at the top to compel people at the bottom to do what they want is getting harder and harder, which is why the Soviet Union collapsed, basically, because it's an unworkable economic model on a large scale. It's a workable model on a small scale. The way that works but is harder to understand is the decentralized coordination, where each person owns certain stuff, does certain stuff, and trades with other people. And if there aren't enough chainsaws, the result is the price of chainsaws goes up, and now some people find it in their interest to make chainsaws. And if there isn't enough wood, so forth. And really understanding that as a decentralized coordination mechanism is moderately hard. It takes, I would say, about a year of price theory. And if you haven't taken the course, my book is available for free on the web, and you can read it. Because it's really intended to be the equivalent of that, price theory. But it works pretty well. It doesn't work perfectly, but the very fact that we're alive is evidence that it works pretty well. And let me start with a simplified model, simplified with the objective of being understandable and solvable. And that's the model of perfect competition that economists like to start their textbooks with. And in perfect competition, we assume that the number of people doing everything is so large that each person can reasonably assume that his actions don't affect anything. So when I'm deciding whether to make another chainsaw, I don't have to worry that if I do so, the price of chainsaws will go down. Because after all, there are 100,000 chainsaws sold each year. I'm deciding whether to make 5 or 6 of them. That's not going to affect the price enough to, for me to care about. So that's one assumption, that we can let each person not worry about the effects of his action except for the direct effect of making something and selling it, and he gets the money. Second assumption is complete information, that individuals' willingness to buy stuff reflects the actual value of that stuff to them. And you might reject that either because people are making a mistake, they're being defrauded or something, or because you believe that people are wrong about what's important to them. So you say, we observe heroin addicts are willing to pay for heroin, but some of us think that's a mistake. And another important assumption is that all transactions are voluntary, which means not only that there's no theft, but also there aren't any torts, because, you know, when I run my car into you, that's an involuntary transaction, too. And we'll be talking a bit about how we get beyond that model in the law and econ part of this course. But the claim is that for some market settings, it's a pretty good approximation. If you're thinking about the grain market, for example, where there are an awful lot of farmers. And it has the big advantage over more complicated models that we can solve it. You can actually use economic theory to say, if you did have a perfectly competitive market, here's what would happen. And one of the interesting things you can show is that that market, in a certain sense, maximizes the size of the pie. That if you let, that if in that situation you just let people buy and sell at whatever price they want, you end up with people in total doing a better job of achieving their objectives than with any alternative. And making a precise version of that is complicated, and so I'm not going to do that here. Take my law and econ class or something if you wanted to do that. But I'm just going to say, in some intuitive sense, we can talk about how well the society results in people getting what they want. If the conditions of perfect competition are met, then just leaving the market alone doesn't. And one virtue of that analysis is that if you want to increase the size of the pie, one way is by looking for places where the assumptions don't hold. So you can say, look, if it were perfectly competitive, this would happen. I suspect that there are ways of making the outcome better. Why? Because in this area there's a monopoly. Why? Because in this area there's imperfect information. Various things like that. And that's a useful first step in trying to figure out how to improve the world. So that's why this stuff is all useful, I think. One reason. Let's now go into the standard stuff that everybody has read and a lot of people don't understand very well, which is demand and supply curves. That if you say how much do you want something, or do you want something, we usually don't notice that the real answer to that question has to be something at a particular price. So that, for example, I've just been reading about a new little computer that Sony has out, which is really cute. It weighs 1.5 pounds. They claim you can put it into a jacket pocket, and I've done some measurements, and I don't think I could quite get it, but I can certainly get it into this pocket. It's basically about yay wide and yay high. And really nice little computer. And if somebody offered it to me for $15, I would say, yes, I have no need of that, but isn't that a cute toy? I'll buy it. Unfortunately, it costs $900. $900, I'm not going to get it. All right, I've already got something which is a near equivalent that I don't use very much that costs about $300, a netbook. And I've got this, which is what I mostly use. So the right question is not do you want it, but at what price do you want it? Or how many do you want at what price if you're buying not computers but apples or something? And a demand curve is a way of reflecting that relationship. So that I could say that suppose it's the case, this is price, this is quantity. Suppose it's the case for me that when I went into the grocery store and saw that apples, due to a bad harvest, were $5 a piece, that at a price of $5, I in fact wanted 0 apples, even though I like apples quite a lot. But if there had been a good harvest and the price had been down at $1, apples are pretty good.
little expensive, but I'll still buy an apple a day for my family. So at that point, we have, if I, this is my weekly consumption, I would buy 7 apples at a price of $1. And if it got down to 25 cents, I'd buy up a lot more apples. So we could then graph that, assuming we had all the intermediate points as well. That's what's called a demand curve. And what does that do? It says, at any price, how many would I choose to buy? Economists usually draw straight line demand curves. There is no reason in reality why a demand curve should be a straight line. It's just easier to draw straight lines than curves. All right, so I drew a curve one just to be rambunctious. All right, so that's what a demand curve shows. One of the things that confuses people is, well, let me start with, that's my demand curve. Suppose we had another demand curve for you, and you, as it happens, either are poorer than I am or don't like apples as much, and you have a straight line demand curve to make life easy. What's the demand curve for us? Well, the answer is that if apples are anywhere in this price range, you're not buying any. So therefore, our combined demand curve down to here is that. On the other hand, if apples got down to the point where they were giving them away, you buy this many, I buy this many, so we buy this plus this, which is out here. So if you think about it, the combined demand curve is the horizontal sum, because the quantity we buy, this is the quantity axis, the quantity we buy is the quantity I buy plus the quantity you buy, so we just sum up in this direction, all right? And that would give us our combined demand curve. And you could do the same thing if there were a million of us, all right? That's where demand curves come from, so to speak. They reflect how people would act at various prices. Questions? No questions? No. All right. One of the things that causes confusion, let me... Actually, I was going to try to follow my usual policy of photographing the board after I take pictures. I'll keep doing that. One of the things that causes confusion is the distinction between the changes in demand, meaning changes in the curve itself, and changes in quantity demanded. If the curve doesn't change, why would the number of apples I want to buy change? What's the obvious reason the number of apples I want to buy would change? What? The price changes, right? So a good deal of confusion, something I'd go into in more detail if this were an economics course instead of a week or two on economics, is between shifts in demand. Suppose we had a demand curve like that, and then something changed. There was a news story saying apples were really good for you. And now people are willing to buy more apples at any given price, so the demand curve shifts from here to here. That's a shift in demand. That's not at all the same thing as a shift in quantity demanded, which could be that, or could be prices change, so it's gone from here to here. And it's worth keeping track of it, because you can get into a lot of tangles if you say, well, the price went up, so demand went down. That's wrong. The price went up, so quantity demanded went down. That doesn't change demand. Demand changed. Now that'll change the price, but that's just moving you along the new demand curve. Anyway, so worth making the distinction. Now we get to the interesting bit. And the interesting bit is the magic trick by which we can use demand curves to say something about the value to me of being able to buy stuff. So suppose we ask the question, here's my demand curve for apples, and the question is, how much better off would I be if the price of apples fell from whatever this is, let's make it a per, well, whatever units these are. If the price fell from here to here, how in principle could we say how much better off I am? And the non-economist might say, well, how much money would you save? And I say, well, I might not save any money at all, because, of course, at the lower price, I'll buy more apples. So it may be that I'll be spending more money on apples when the price goes down. So I have less money. Am I worse off? No, less money, but more apples, and I like the apples. And the answer to this question goes as follows. Let this be one apple per week, say. What does this demand curve tell me? It tells me that I would be willing to buy one apple instead of none, even at this high price. All right? So the value of one apple to me is up somewhere around here. Apples are sort of lumpy. It'd be easier if I were doing continuous things, but then we have to do calculus. Some of you don't like calculus. So think of it as one apple is worth about that much to me, which we know because I'm willing to buy one apple at that price. So if I'm actually buying apples at this price, that first apple represents a gain to me of that much. Suppose I can buy all the apples I like at this price. I'm getting an apple I was willing to pay, let's say, $4 for. I only have to pay $2 for it, so I've gotten a $2 gain. The apple's worth $2 more than I paid for it. How about the next apple I buy? Well, I wouldn't be willing to pay as much to have two apples instead of one as one instead of zero, right? Apples, like most things, we value less when we got more of them. But I'd be willing to pay this much. So the next apple, the difference between its value to me and the price is that. Keep doing that through here, and we have what's called my consumer surplus, which is the difference between the total value to me of the quantity of apples I'm buying and the total amount I've got to pay. All right? A different way of putting it is you could say, look, the first apple was worth this much to me, because I was willing to buy an apple at that price, the next one this much. So the total value to me of all the apples is this figure on it. What am I paying for them? I'm paying the quantity of apples I'm buying times the price, which is just this rectangle. Subtract this rectangle from this figure, you're left with a triangle. All right. So it's a very simple idea, but it's really quite a powerful idea, because what it tells us is, if I knew how many apples somebody would buy at any price, I could then say how much better off he was as a result of being able to buy apples at this price. And we say, well, suppose price dropped to here. Price drops to here. Now my surplus is above this line. So what's my gain when the price drops? My gain is of two parts. This rectangle is what I'm saving on the apples I would have bought anyway. All right, they've dropped in price from $2 to $1. I'm buying whatever, six of them. That saved me $6. Same apples. This is the extra benefit I get because of the lower price I buy more apples. They're apples that weren't worth buying at this price, but they're worth buying at the lower price. And on each of them, I'm getting whatever the difference is between the value of the apple to me and the price. All right? So the economist's answer is that when the price drops from $2 to $1, I gain by that figure. All right? This is sort of very standard price theory, but it's also something most people in the world don't know, and therefore it's worth going through. Questions? How many of you actually knew all of this because of the econ classes you've taken before? Curious. Yes. Two. All right. That is worth it.
I forgot most of it.
Yeah, that's one of the problems. You're not using it. No reason why you would remember most of it. So, as I say, I've got a text version of this here, and following out the argument, the consumer surplus on buying all the apples I wish to buy at a dollar an apple is that area. And you can use this for lots of other things. Suppose, for example, that I happen to be the apple monopolist. I've got the only orchard in the world, or at least close enough. And I say to myself, well, I could sell apples at $2, and I'd make $2 times this quantity, or I could sell them at a dollar and make this quantity. But I'm cleverer than that. And what I'm actually going to do is, it turns out it costs me a dollar an apple to produce apples. That's what I got to pay my apple pickers or something. So what I'm going to do is to say to you, the customer who has this demand curve, I've got this deal for you. I'll sell you apples for a dollar a piece. But there's this one little catch. I only sell apples to members of the Apple Club. And the annual fee for the Apple Club happens to be the area of this triangle. So what I'm doing is getting you to buy apples all the way out to here, where the value of the last apple is the cost of me producing it. But instead of giving you the benefit from getting all those apples, I'm charging it as an annual fee. And this is a real issue if you think about things like how Disneyland ought to price their rides, where they can choose between a per-ride price and an admission price and some combination of the two. And from their standpoint, what they want to do is to set the admission price, to set the per ride price to maximize the net gain to customers plus Disneyland, and then set the admission price to transfer that gain to Disneyland by, in effect, charging you for your consumer surplus. That's not a perfectly competitive market, obviously, but it's an example of the fact that consumer surplus is useful both for arguments that are about how much better off are we if we do or don't have price control and things like that, but also for arguments about how certain firms can maximize their profits by using this to say how valuable is what I'm selling my customers. And again, if we were spending more time, I'd go into more of this. But yes?
But the value is not a unitless quantity, right? It's
how not a what?
It's not unitless the area.
No, of course not.
So how would you convert that to, you couldn't convert it to a dollar sum.
Sure you could.
You'd have to know how many apples were being.
That is, in this particular case, the units on the quantity are apples per week. The units on the vertical axis are dollars per apple. Multiply those together and get dollars per week. So we charge you some number of dollars per week for an admission fee. Right. Checking units is a good exercise to make sure you haven't made a mistake. What is true, though, one problem with the kind of price discrimination I've just described is that it works best if all your customers are identical. Because otherwise, the Apple Club price that gets all the consumer surplus from the guy who really likes apples results in the next guy down the list not buying any apples because you're asking him for more than all of his consumer surplus, and he'd rather do without apples than that. Turns out you can make the same argument the other direction for a supply curve. Demand curve shows how much a consumer will buy as a function of the price. The supply curve shows how much a producer will sell. A point I should have made and didn't. If you think through the fact that the combined demand curve is just the horizontal sum, it's pretty easy to show that the combined consumer surplus you get from just using the combined demand curve. So it's not just a person by person, it's also true for everybody. On the other hand, to say there are problems if you're a price discriminating monopolist, because then you've got to deal with the customer by customer. Supply curve is the same idea. Again, quantity here, price here. But what that's showing is, according to what price you can collect for the goods, how many you'll choose to produce. And generally, the higher the price that you're being offered, the more you're willing to produce. The more hours you're willing to work, the more you're willing to spend on fertilizer, if it's crops and so on. And it turns out, if you think about it, why is it that when the price goes from here to here, you produce these extra units? Because they were units that at the old price weren't quite worth producing, at the new price are worth producing. So this chunk of the curve also tells us what's the cost to you of producing those units, which means that if you're selling the units here, then that's your gain, the difference between the extra cost you of producing the extra units and the money you got by selling them. And therefore, that just as with consumer surplus, the area of the triangle, except in the real world, is not really a triangle because that's not a straight line, but I'll use straight lines because everybody else does, and it's easier to draw. The area of that is the producer's benefit from producing. And since finally, we expect that where the price will actually be is where demand curve and supply curve cross, because if the price were higher than that, producers would be trying to produce more than consumers wanted to buy, so the price would go down. Other way, if it was less. So therefore, we end up with the standard supply-demand diagram, and this triangle represents the benefit to consumers plus producers of that market. So that's really quite useful, because if you want to use economic